quote, "What I like about casinos is that they allow us to build hotels. A slot machine or a blackjack or a roulette table, they have no power. It's the non-casino stuff that gets people to come back again and again," close quote. With us today, the man who said that, and who by universal agreement reinvented Las Vegas, Steve Wynn. Shooting at the Wynn Las Vegas, Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Wynn Resorts, the owner and operator of luxury casino resorts in the United States and China, on revenues in 2013 of $5.6 billion, net income of more than $1 billion, and a stock price that has risen over the last 5 years from roughly $37 to well over $200, more than quintupling in value. With us today, the company's founder, chairman, and chief executive officer, and by wide agreement, the man who reinvented Las Vegas, Steve Wynn. Steve, I ordinarily thank guests for joining us, but since we're shooting today not only in your hotel, but in your home, this is your villa at the Wynn Las Vegas, thank you for permitting us to join you.
I was listening to your introduction, and one thought passed through my mind. Better to be lucky than smart.
Okay, new kid in town. In 1967, 25-year-old Steve Wynn arrives in Las Vegas with money from the family business, a string of bingo parlors back east. He buys a small stake in the Frontier. Steve, this town in 1967, I once heard you say that Las Vegas hotels, when you got here, were more like motels than real hotels. What did this town look like in those days?
There were 160,000 people. There were 8 or 9 hotels on the Strip. They were, with one or two exceptions, low-rise structures. And if they had a high-rise, it was with 300 or 400 rooms. Del Webb had built the Sahara that had 1,000 rooms. The Stardust was basically a motel with 1,400 rooms. The rest of them were 2- and 3-story structures with little small high-rises attached to them. Small casinos with 300 slot machines and 40 games and a showroom. And it was a small town, a company town.
And what brought you here in the first place from upstate New York? You grew up in upstate New York. You were operating bingo parlors.
When my father died and when I was a senior in school on the table in heart surgery, we were broke. It was my senior year at Penn. I graduated and I had the business, the family business in Maryland, and I had the bingo that was licensed in Maryland. And I had run it while I was a student. That's how I got my allowance. I'd go down from Philadelphia to Washington every weekend and run the bingo. And I wanted to be a developer. And because I was in a county that was adjacent to the Baltimore-Washington International Airport,
right,
I wanted to build an industrial park, and I could buy a farm for $1 million that was next to the airport, and I could get it zoned for the airport. Other people might have had a hard time, but I knew my way around the county. I thought I could get the zoning. And I didn't have any money. I was worth about $50,000 or $25,000. Right. And I found John MacArthur of Bankers Life and Casualty and offered him half of it if he would lend me the $1 million to buy the farm. He said no. But he asked me a bunch of questions about where I'd gone to school and how was my business legal and all those sort of thing. And I left and I went back to Maryland, and 2 weeks later I got a phone call from his office saying that Mr. MacArthur, he and Getty were the two richest Americans at the time. He owned Bankers Life and Casualty by himself. Wanted to see me again in New York, and that he'd pay for my airfare. Well, I paid my own airfare and went up to the Plaza Hotel, and I sat with him. And in effect, he told me that the insurance company owned this land on the Strip, a closed hotel called the Last Frontier. The insurance company had been trying to sell it to get rid of it, and so far had been unsuccessful, but a group of men had come to him to lease it for a very, very big price. He would add $5 million for a high rise, for more rooms.
Right.
And he said that he would like to have someone in the lessee group that represented his interests. Would I like to go there? And he would arrange me to get 2 or 3 or 4% for virtually nothing, a few thousand dollars, $25,000. And he said he'd pay my way to go check it out. And I said, I'd pay my own way. And I ended up on Thanksgiving of 1965 in Las Vegas.
You're 23 years old.
23 years old. with my wife, Elaine, and I was with a friend of my father's who had arranged for me to meet MacArthur. And we started this little weekend in Palm Springs, and we were at a restaurant called Ruby's Dunes, and Sinatra was at the next table with some people.
Totally by happenstance.
By luck. And he walked over to say hello to the guy I was with. And we got introduced. He said, what are you doing out here? He said, well, we're going to Las Vegas tomorrow because Steve has been invited to join a deal for a new hotel on the Strip. Sinatra did a double take. I looked like I was about 16 years old. So did Elaine. What hotel on the Strip? I quickly sort of described what Mr. MacArthur was doing. And he said to Herb, where are you staying? He said, well, we'll stay at the Dunes. No, you won't. You'll stay with me. You'll stay with me at the Sands. I'll take care for you and the young people here. And the next thing you know, we're in Las Vegas, guests of Frank Sinatra, staying in a suite when everybody in the world is crowded into the Sands to get a glimpse of the Rat Pack.
But these were the classic days of the Rat Pack.
It was it. They were there. You can't really explain to people today what it was like. We went to the showroom, the Sands showroom, had 500 seats. The Copa Room, where the Rat Pack worked, was a tiny nightclub.
How many seats have you got here at the Wynn Las Vegas?
Oh, 1,500 usually. Nothing, okay. Everything's big now. But right, it was right, 500, right.
Okay, 500 seats.
Joint. We were in line. We're at the end of the line. We come to the maitre d', you know, typical guy with the card, and we say, Wynn, Liebert. The guy says, hello, Mr. Wynn. Welcome to Sands. Says to the captain, take them to booth 5. We get taken in. There's 497 people in that room. Right. We walk in. The older guy and the two of us, we look like his kids. And we sit in a booth in the center of the ringside. On the right is Lucille Ball, Elizabeth Taylor, and other people. On the left is Gregory and Veronique Peck and Roger Moore and his wife. Everybody in the room is somebody or a giant customer of the Sands.
Right.
They had some dancing girls like the Copa girls, and they went off stage. And without an announcement, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, and Joey Bishop walk out. The place goes nuts. Everybody is cheering because Sinatra and Martin and Davis knew everybody that was in the room.
Got it.
And so they start walking around the apron of the proscenium. Hi, Lizzie. Hi, Lucy. Hi, Greg. Hi, Bernie. You know, hi, Raj. Like this kind of stuff. Sinatra says, how do you like the seat, kid? Everybody looks at me and say, what mafioso's son is that, you know, or whatever they
think. Right.
I mean, it was so funny, so cool. Dean Martin, Mr. Cool, Frank Sinatra, the boss, Sammy Davis, the court jester with more talent than anybody. Peter Lawford and Joey Bishop were sort of like furniture.
Steve, you're a big time businessman, but what you're telling us is you came to this, you fell in love.
I had no intention of staying. I just wanted to take my wife on a vacation. When my dad died, we never had a honeymoon.
Right.
So it was 2 years later, from 63 to 65, I figure this will be fun.
Right.
The maitre d' said to me, when the show is over, stay in the seat. We get taken, when the showroom empties, through the back to the lounge. There's Louis Prima, Keeley Smith, Sam Butera, and the witnesses on stage. Two reserve tables. We sit down in the reserve table. 1,000 people, the casino's cramming to see this. It was an open lounge.
Right.
5 minutes later, here comes Frank and Dean and Sammy sit next to us. And on my first night in Las Vegas, I end up sitting next to them watching Louis Prima and Keeley Smith.
Fantastic.
And at that point, I am toasted. I'm going, I'm staying. I don't care what the heck is going on anywhere else. I got to figure out a way to be around here, what fun this is.
So you buy a small stake in the Frontier.
I was a slot manager and assistant credit manager.
It emerges, not long after you buy this stake, that some of the shareholders in the Frontier are fronting for the Detroit mob. And you,
exactly.
Nobody accuses you, but you sell out.
I'll tell you how I got lucky in the Frontier. The only time I myself came within spitting distance of what you'd call bad guys.
Right.
Was in that early days when I was a slot manager at the Frontier. Incidentally, the place opened in July of 67 and was sold to Hughes in November. The whole experience lasted 4 months. Now, at that time, Howard Hughes' banker, Perry Thomas, who owned the Valley Bank, the Thomas and Mac Arena here in town, he's 92 years old. He's become my second father ever since I was that age.
Right.
Perry Thomas was trying to buy the Frontier for Hughes. I didn't like the people in the hotel because they didn't know what they were doing. I wanted to go home. So I was lobbying other shareholders from California, some other shareholders, that we ought to sell to Hughes, which put me in odds with the guys from Detroit who didn't want to sell to Hughes. But I was sort of the agent of the Mormon banker, Perry Thomas.
Got it.
As it turns out, the U.S. attorney testified in a letter for me when I got licensed in New Jersey that on the wiretaps that the government had, the guys from the Detroit guys in Las Vegas talking to the ones in Detroit were complaining about me that I was causing the place to be sold by lobbying the other shareholders. And he wrote a letter that not only was Mr. Wynn had nothing to do with those people, he thwarted their efforts to stop the sale to Hughes. So I was very lucky that I was in the wrong place, but the government happened to be the witness.
Got it.
And at 25 years old, it could have turned out differently.
Right.
I could have been tainted by that.
Right.
That's the only time that I became remotely close to that stuff.
Got it.
And the right. banker convinced me to stay.
It was Hughes Banker.
And his son is my colleague who did all our designing with me of the hotels all these years.
Okay. This is another piece. This is a theme in your story. You collect people. People seem to stay with you. We'll get to that in a moment. So you sell the Frontier. You do a couple of land deals.
Well, I went in the liquor business with the help of my banker.
Liquor
I became
business?
A distributor in Reno and Las Vegas
right.
of liquor, wine, and beer.
And then you buy a big enough stake in the Golden Nugget downtown.
Then I bought the key thing.
Okay.
Was Howard Hughes sold me the corner next to Caesars for $1 million, $1,100,000.
Why? Why did he sell to you? He was famous for holding on to everything.
It was a strange, narrow piece of property that had come into his ownership by means that no one quite understood. And it was in his name. I bought it from Howard Robarts Hughes Jr., not the Hughes Tool Company. This strange, silly piece of property was purchased in his name. When the people that took over Hughes's operation, when he left town, tried to find out how it came into ownership by Hughes,
right.
neither he nor anybody else could answer the question. And he was mystified himself. And my banker, Perry Thomas, intervened and had Hughes sell me the piece of property because it wasn't next to anything that Hughes owned. And he lent me the $1.2 million to buy it, including $100,000 for interest. 10 months later, I sold it for $2.25 million to Caesar's Palace. I made my first $1 million. I was 29 years old. And I paid my tax. I had a partner, Abe Rosenberg, that owned a third, who owned J&B Scotch, who had signed the note at the bank with me. And on my $600,000, I invested in the Golden Nugget and got control of the company. And that's been the size of my whole investment from day one,
$600,000.
$600,000. Made on a land deal with Hughes.
You got control of the Golden Nugget. Now, that's moving pretty quickly through an interesting chapter right there.
I was 30.
You were 30. You end up as chairman of the Golden Nugget. Now, as best I can tell from
no rooms, just a casino.
Just a casino.
Little casino had 1,800,000 shares of stock at $3 or $4 a share, about a $7 million company.
Got it.
And I got 10% of the place for $600,000, something like that.
And you began rebuilding the Golden Nugget.
Yes.
You rebuild the Golden Nugget.
At a time when such things were possible. In
Why
life, everything
Why
is about timing.
Okay.
Everybody thought that Las Vegas was the underworld.
Right.
It wasn't. They were gone.
Got it.
It was too early for Wall Street to come yet. But the Mormon banker knew about it, and he said to me when I wanted to go home when we sold the Frontier, Steve, you should stay here. The town needs young people. You'll end up owning the place. He actually said those words to me. My net worth was $50,000. Everything from that point forward was with the help of the Mormon banker. He lent me the money. He got me in control position at the Nugget. He and First Security of Utah, the bank of the LDS Church,
right.
lent me my first $12 million to build my rooms at the Nugget. I was in the right place at the right time. You know, there's an awful lot of hard work and smart people, but they don't always find themselves so much the beneficiary of timing and opportunity. In my case, I just fell into it.
next chapter here, mid-1970s, New Jersey voters approved casinos in Atlantic City. In 1978, you buy a piece of property in Atlantic City, you rip it down, you build the Atlantic City Golden Nugget, and you operate that profitably for not quite a decade, and you sell it in 1987 to Bally's to come back to this town. Why did you go into Atlantic City and why did you get out?
The business opportunity in Atlantic City, they opened in Memorial Day of 78.
Right.
The same weekend that I opened the Golden Nugget for a 600-room hotel, called the Golden Nugget Rooming House. I was a ski friend. I'm a powder skier and a skier.
Right.
And the president of Resorts International was Jack Davis, was a powder skier with me.
Right.
We used to ski together in Utah. Jack Davis had invited me the year before to see the boardwalk and said, next year we're opening, it's gonna be a big thing, you should be here, Steve. I said, I'm building my hotel in Las Vegas, I don't wanna come here. I made a mistake. A Memorial Day rolls around. I have the best weekend in the history of the Golden Nugget because I have rooms. I'm all proud of myself. And Jack Davis on television, because Resorts opened in New Jersey. I call Jack Davis and say, Jack, I saw you on TV. It looks great. He says, it's unbelievable. I said, we opened the hotel this weekend. I broke all my records. We did $50,000 in slot machine business for the weekend. Now, the place used to do $4,000 or $5,000 a day. We did $10,000 or $8,000 a day. I said, how did you do? He gets quiet on the phone, and he said, actually, we did $150,000. I thought, for a weekend? My God, three times as much as the Nugget. And then after a beat, he says, a day. What? We did $700,000 the first 3 days in slots. We're having trouble counting the money from the tables because it's all stacked up in box crates. What? Steve, get on the plane and come here. The next day, I was on the plane. And I went to see Jack Davis, and I walked in his office at Resorts International. Couldn't get through the crowds to get to the elevator. He's sitting back in his desk, and I told you so. Okay, we're gonna get some land. He says, go see Manny Solomon at the Strand Motel, at the opposite end of the boardwalk. He wanted to put me as far away as he could. And I went to see Manny Solomon and bought the property the next day. And it looked so good.
Right.
And everybody was rushing and remodeling these dumpy old hotels. I said, if I build a new one that's all bright and shiny,
right,
they want the Las Vegas experience, I'll be the guy that gives it to them. And it took me an extra year. I didn't open till 79, 80. But the advantage we had, even though we were the smallest one, was so great that at the end of 3 years, we had made more money than the other guys, including there's a head start. So, you know, it's again, what you offer the public. And the Golden Nugget of Atlantic City was a big hit because I got Sinatra to come and be the spokesman and hang out with me. And then Dean Martin joined us.
So why'd you sell in 87?
Because no matter what I said to the government, two governors, that they had to take control of that city away from the local government. They were so corrupt and stupid. The local government was the pits. And I kept saying to governors of New Jersey, you must take control of the central planning of this community if it's to save itself. Right now you're the monopoly on the East Coast. That will end someday.
Right.
And the infrastructure of this city has to be so big that it's like Las Vegas. Las Vegas is surviving in spite of everything because of the infrastructure here is so big. The menu for guests is
right.
So great.
Right.
Atlantic City can't just be a local crap game. It's got to be a destination city. But for that, the government had to take over the New Jersey state government, not the local Atlantic City government, which was pathetic. Well, they wouldn't, and they didn't. And I came at one point of the view that Atlantic City was never going to take advantage of its opportunity and would eventually face obsolescence, which I'm afraid is true today. And so when the opportunity came to sell, I jumped at it. And I had already bought the property on the Strip from Hughes's nephew. That is Treasure Island and the Mirage.
All right, which brings us back to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And here comes the reinvention of this town. While you're operating in Atlantic City, Las Vegas has some tough times. Tourism drops, there's a lack of new construction, and a sense in this town, late 70s, mid 80s, that the best days of Las Vegas are behind it. It's losing its competitive edge. And then Steve Wynn returns and spends more than $600 million building the Mirage, making it the most expensive casino to that point in history. It opens in November 1989 with more than 3,000 rooms, an artificial volcano, lions and tigers in the Siegfried and Roy show, acrobats from Cirque du Soleil. In 93, you do it again. You open Treasure Island, $450 million casino with a lake and a pirate ship. 1998, again, Bellagio, $1.6 billion resort, 4,000 rooms, more than 100,000 square feet of gaming space. To this day, one of the big things to do in this town is go over to the Bellagio in the evening and watch the Fountains of Bellagio, the show. So this is investments of more than $2.6 billion in a town that when you came back for Steve Wynn round two, had grown seedy. So the question here is, what did you think you were doing?
The analysis of the Hilton, the MGM, and Caesars underpinned the business plan and the opportunity that would define the Mirage. There had been 2,000 and 2,500 room hotels, but there'd never been a 3,000 room hotel in the world. MGM was about tour and travel, and they had a shopping center downstairs. Hilton was about food and beverage and convention. Caesars was about the leverage of the casino and international business baccarat. If you combine the three, there was clearly a business plan there that would produce a return on $600 million. And the worst case would be 150 or 160. We did 225 right out of the box.
Wow.
Now, that proved that you could invest. It was a $200 million town before that as far as investment.
Right.
Now all of a sudden we had tripled the capital. And Mirage, I was asked while the governor was present when I unveiled the model of Mirage before we broke ground, what's the importance of this facility town? Mm-hmm. I said, I think it's going to be a great investment for our shareholders. But really, the most important thing about the Mirage will be that it will show that Las Vegas is a safe place to invest over $500 million. I didn't realize when I said it how prophetic that statement was. Mm-hmm. Because it unleashed, as you mentioned in your introduction, a decade of billions of dollars of investment. You know, these things occurred sequentially. And I might add, again referring to timing, think of the late 80s and the early 90s. That was the era of the Japanese investment of America. Right. The wave of, we had customers, one after another, who nobody had ever heard of, that came and put up $1 million to gamble, $2 million to gamble. I mean, the Japanese.
So it was the first big international money?
Big wave. It was a tsunami, to use a current term. When it came into the mid-90s, I knew that you could buy the Desert Inn. And I had advised Nick Pritzker of Hyatt when he came to see me, how can we get into here? I said, buy the Desert Inn. It's got water rights. It's next. It's got a, the Desert Inn had the front on the strip, but the back across from the convention
center. But it was way at the north end of the strip. Didn't matter?
No, listen, the development makes a location, not the location makes a development.
Okay.
I remind you that the Dunes went bankrupt twice after Caesars and MGM were open on the number one corner. When I bought the Dunes, I paid $400,000 an acre for it. No one wanted it. Can you imagine that in 1994? No one wanted 166 acres with a golf course on the strip except me. And I offered Sumitomo Bank $70 million for 166 acres.